Case number 201043, John Doe v. Michigan State University et al. Oral arguments not to exceed 15 minutes per side. Mr. Eric John Rosenberg for the appellant.
Good afternoon. Counsel, you may proceed with your argument.
Thank you, Your Honor. On behalf of Appellant John Doe, I've requested 5-minute rebuttal time. And I'd like to thank you for this opportunity to discuss the district court's error in allowing appellees to violate the University of Cincinnati and Baum decisions by permitting Title IX complainants to refuse to answer pre-approved cross-examination questions without threat of any inference, negative inference to their credibility. Now,
explain to me what the process for pre-approval was exactly.
Well, the pre-approval, as appellees concede, there was a judge who was nominated to handle the hearing, and he was the gatekeeper of relevancy. So he approved these questions that Row 1 refused to answer. And unfortunately, it demonstrates Michigan State's history of defying Baum in Cincinnati, because it took a lawsuit and a TRO motion to get appellees to give Doe a live hearing.
Well, now, wait a minute. So they had been pre-approved by the administrative law judge who conducted the hearing, and she refused to answer the questions. Was there any further ruling on that by the ALJ?
Well, Your Honor, part of the problem, we can't answer that question without a full transcript, because a full transcript was denied here. And the most reasonable inference as to why.
You requested a transcript.
Well, Your Honor, I didn't represent the appellant at the lower level, but my understanding is the transcript was requested, it was discussed, and it was denied. In fact, what happened, Your Honor, was Michigan State offered 6 pages of a transcript, and the most reasonable inference of why they only gave 6 pages is because it disproves the arguments that appellees are making in this case. But getting back to the issue of the fact that Doe was denied a hearing, it was 18 months after the University of Cincinnati was decided and 6 months after Baum was decided. So in cross-examination, Your Honor, was critical here because Doe's accusers largely eliminated his ability to gather exculpatory evidence or present it in this he said, she said case by waiting years to make their allegations against Doe. Then, making matters worse, appellees expelled Doe and terminated his lifelong goal of becoming a doctor by stripping key due process protections from Baum and Cincinnati by creating this pick and choose cross-examination policy that prohibited Doe from exploring the demeanor and credibility objectives contemplated in these decisions.
Was this hearing, is my recollection correct, that this hearing lasted for 3 days?
Well, we don't know. Well, it was 3 days, but how long we don't know, because again, without the full transcript, we can't figure that out. So the most logical inference would be to look at the full transcript, which we don't have here. And it wasn't, if you look at the testimony provided at the hearing in front of the district court, it didn't last that long. I think it was, you know, total of a few hours each day. How long, we really don't know. But in blessing this pick and choose scheme, the district court hollowed out this court's cross-examination mandates by allowing complainants rather than the universities to decide which cross-examination questions would be answered.
What would the line be, though? Surely we can't allow kind of unfettered cross-examination. We don't even allow that in court. What's the logical line for what questions the administrative law judge or hearing official could say you don't have to answer?
Well, Your Honor, as here there's no dispute these questions were relevant as deemed by the judge. Appellee agrees he was the gatekeeper of relevancy. In addition, appellees concede that a student's refusal to answer cross-examination questions would run afoul of Cincinnati and Baum under certain circumstances. So
might we be expected, without knowing the questions, without your even being able to give us your client's version of what the questions were, whether you have a transcript or not, how in the world would you expect us to be able to say that a refusal to answer 2 questions amounted to a denial of due process given the length of this hearing? I mean, it doesn't make any sense that we should rule that something that we don't know what was could possibly be a due process violation.
Well, Your Honor, that's almost exactly my point. And if this was a summary judgment decision, I could understand your position. This is a motion to dismiss stage under Baum, where it's a beyond a wing or a prayer. And what's happening is the vast majority of the arguments made by appellees would make sense if you had a full transcript. We don't have a full transcript. What we have is a district court judge who acknowledged that John Doe was precluded from asking at least two categories of questions of the complainants. The judge even said that he understood that the Doe wanted to ask questions of both complainants who didn't answer them. So, you know, when you look to Baum or you look to Marshall, I think Marshall's a perfect example of a great decision on this, that the university can't have it both ways. They can't deny the plaintiff access.
Counsel, let me ask you this then. Do you have to have the second amended complaint in this case in order to prevail then? Because that's where your transcript claim is. And I'm a little bit confused about the questions. I think there's at least some indication in the record that the general content of the questions came out, but also it's in the proposed second amended complaint too, or maybe it's only in the second amended complaint. I don't know, but do you need that second amended complaint here?
We don't, Your Honor, because if you look at the transcript from the district, the hearing on the motion to dismiss, the first amended complaint talked about unanswered questions. The judge asks Doe's attorney at the time, what was that all about? And there's a discussion which addressed the issues related to the unanswered two categories. So you don't need to go to the second amended complaint to explore this issue. The arguments were made in the motions to dismiss.
What about the specific request for the transcript? Is that encompassed broadly by the original complaint or the first amended complaint, or is that something that really is only in the second amended complaint?
The reference to the transcript, I believe, is in the only second amended complaint, but again, it's not relevant to the plausibility here, because what happened was the appellees are making arguments based on a full transcript in their motion to dismiss. And those issues were addressed at the oral hearing on this issue. So the court did not need the second amended complaint to rule on these issues at all.
So you're saying that the appellees relied on the full transcript just in answering your arguments in district court, but haven't disclosed that full transcript to you?
In part, yes, Your Honor, because they gave six pages of the transcript in to rebut the motion for leave to file a second amended complaint and withheld the rest.
Is that something that you could just get in a discovery request or no, document production?
I do these cases all over the country. Getting a hold of those transcripts, I've made public records requests for them and not received them in these cases. So, No, it's not something you can just get before you file a lawsuit.
Counsel, just to understand what's before us here on appeal, the equal protection claim and the Title IX claims are no longer pending, or at least not before us on appeal. It's only the due process claim. Is that correct?
That is correct, Your Honor.
And with regard to the due process claim, that pertains to the failure for these witnesses to be required to answer certain questions, and that's really the only matter that's before us in connection with this appeal. Is that right?
This is correct, Your Honor. Two categories of questions, not just two questions,
okay.
But two categories.
Okay, now, in connection with this due process claims of your client, are these claims being asserted in connection with a claim for money damages or injunctive relief?
They're being sought in injunctive relief of the prospective injunctive relief.
Okay, so there are no claims for money damages, so we don't have to worry about sovereign immunity under the 11th Amendment, anything like that?
No, Your Honor, the briefing touches on that issue, and no.
Okay. All right. Just to follow up, with regard to the questions being asked a moment ago by Judge Gibbons, to know what the due process violation is. You can't tell us anything about the information being sought by the questions that were ordered not to be answered. What are we to do about that in assessing the due process claim?
Yeah, Your Honor, and I'll briefly touch on it because I'm almost out of time, but the briefing does talk about that. The most plausible inference that could be drawn from row one, refusing to answer the questions, these categories, they would have disproven three allegations that she made. First, that row one did not engage in nonverbal conduct while taking off her own clothing, which would have suggested she wanted to have sexual contact with Doe. Second, that she was allegedly unable to react to John Doe's advances because she was too intoxicated, something that would have been disproven if she had testified she was sober enough to remove her own clothing, as well as engaging in other activities of consent that John Doe testified she engaged in. And finally, that row one felt she could not resist Doe because he was physically intimidating presence, even though he only weighed 95 pounds. So the questions that were not answered were directly related to those key issues of credibility and demeanor. And I see I'm out of time, so I'll stop there, Your Honor. Thank you.
Can I just one clarification? That's row one, though, not row two.
And you're correct, Your Honor, not row two. However, with row two, as the district court again acknowledged, there were questions of row two that she didn't answer. We can't identify those because we don't have the transcript, and that's the issue with row two. Thank you.
All right. We'll hear from opposing counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor, and good afternoon. And may it please the court, Scott Eldridge again on behalf of the defendants. Your Honors, what plaintiff received in this case was pretty darn close to a full-blown trial, with both claimants, among other witnesses, subjecting themselves to cross-examination by plaintiff's attorney who represented him during the Baum hearing that he received, which was indeed a three-day hearing that, according to plaintiff's trial counsel in the lower court on the record, stating that it consisted of roughly 8 to 9 hours of total testimony, all, of course, in front of an experienced ALJ who was presiding over the case and ultimately issued a 41-page detailed decision that is part of the record, explaining in excruciating detail how each of those individuals testified. For plaintiff's part,
Is there a transcript? Does a transcript exist?
A transcript does exist, Your Honor, yes.
Why can't they get a copy?
They've never asked for a copy, Your Honor, and it's not, there is no allegation in either the First Amendment complaint or the proposed Second Amendment complaint that they ever actually asked for a copy of the transcript. With respect, and moreover, there's certainly no obligation for MSU to create a transcript in the first place, and them not having a transcript is not a deprivation of due process under the circumstances.
Right. If the motion to dismiss were reversed, would they be able to get the transcript just by making a document request?
If the case were to be remanded and move forward in discovery, I would imagine that would be something that's discoverable, yes. But it's not necessary for you all to rule in this matter and affirm the lower court's decision. Because the question is his lack of having the transcript or his inability to see what the transcript says in total a deprivation of due process? And certainly it's not. His lawyer was present at every single day of the hearing, as was the plaintiff. So they certainly knew what was said. They certainly knew that the transcript, I'm sorry, Your Honor.
It's kind of hard for you to claim they didn't ask for a transcript when they're complaining in their legal papers that they found it impossible to obtain the transcript from you. It's obvious that they're desirous of obtaining the transcript. And this, if you didn't want that to be an issue, you would have made it available.
They're now asking for the transcript. When they filed their complaint, when they filed their First Amended complaint, when they filed their Second Amended complaint, there's no request for the transcript. There's no allegation that they requested the transcript and it was denied. Instead, what their proposed Second Amended complaint says is that MSU is in sole possession of the transcript. But even so, that's not a deprivation of due process, including as explained in the cases that we cited in our briefing, Your Honor. We are not in sole possession of what was said at the Baum hearing. They were there. They were present. They could hear it just as easily as anyone else.
Well, that's and different from having a lawyer have to depend on his recollection or notes. It's different from having the exact transcribed testimony. That's quite a bit different.
Well, it might be different, Your Honor, if the plaintiff also didn't have a record of the proceedings. And the plaintiff has a record of the proceedings, and it's the ALJ's.
What do you mean when you referred to a record of the proceedings? What record are you talking about?
So that includes, Your Honor, certainly the final investigative report that was completed by the investigators, which then, of course, ultimately led to the request for the Baum hearing, which was granted, and he received the full Baum hearing. He also then, of course, received a copy of the resolution officer's decision as a result of the Baum hearing, which again details very well all of the witness testimony, and it's a 41-page decision explaining what it was that was testified to. The other important component of the record vis-a-vis the Baum hearing is that the parties at the Baum hearing agreed beforehand that the statements that were provided, the written statements that were summarized in the final investigative report by the investigators, would be a starting point for their direct testimony, subject to each witness being able to modify it. So they have a complete record of what the facts are, what was said during the hearing. And now we're talking about somehow their lack of a hearing transcript would somehow allow us to answer the question, did Jane Roe One's decision to not answer those two questions amount to a due process violation? That's really what we're talking about here.
Do you agree that at some level, refusing to answer the questions would amount to a due process violation? That there's got to be some line where it just doesn't mean anything if you can refuse to answer every question dealing with your own credibility, something like that, right?
I agree that at some point, yes, if a claimant in this situation refuses to answer a substantial number of questions, that somehow prohibits the trier of fact or the fact finder in this circumstance to adequately assess demeanor and thus credibility, which of course is the purpose of the Baum hearing under the Doe v. Baum case. It's to assess credibility when we have competing narratives. If it deprives that fact finder of the ability to adequately assess and observe demeanor and thus assess credibility, certainly you could come up with a set of circumstances where answering or refusing to answer questions crosses that line. In this case, we certainly don't get there.
Why haven't they alleged, why is it that you can figure out what that line is in any given case on a motion to dismiss? Why haven't they alleged enough in the complaint, especially given that nobody has the transcript, or we haven't seen the transcript, it's not in the record, so it hurts them, but it also hurts you. Why haven't they just alleged, hey, when you ask credibility questions in a credibility case, if you don't answer them, we all agree at some point that's a problem. That's a problem here. Motion to dismiss. Let's go forward.
Well, I have a couple of answers to that, Your Honor. And first is, I want to make sure it's clear actual complaints. First, the operative complaint, which is the first amended complaint, there's only vague reference to the fact that Jane Roe 1 didn't answer certain questions without any specifics as to what those questions were. The second amended complaint simply says that she didn't answer a question about her attire, which was another vague allegation about what the specific question was. And then that she didn't answer a question about her size. In the briefing, they've provided more detail as to what those questions allegedly were that weren't answered, specifically as it relates to the attire piece. And now in their briefing, they're saying she didn't answer a question about whether she took her own clothes off. So the complaint doesn't adequately allege that what they're saying in their brief. It's just not in any of the complaints or the proposed complaint. Second, though, Your Honor, she actually did answer the question, and that's in the record. The question about her clothes coming off, who took them off? It's in the record. It's in the administrative law judge's decision on page 11 and footnote 18. It's page ID 852 in the record, where he said, where the ALJ quotes, Jane Roe 1 has no recollection regarding how her clothes were removed or put back on, end quote, citing two specific page numbers in the transcript. So she did actually answer the question that they now claim she didn't. But I think what we have to do here is think about the larger context in which these two questions were asked and allegedly not answered to the plaintiff's satisfaction. Again, we're talking about a three-day hearing where the plaintiff got to testify after both claimants testified, leaving him free at any time to explain and answer the two questions that he claims now that Jane Roe 1 didn't answer. And so then the question is, does the ALJ then become deprived of observing Jane Roe 1's demeanor when she says, I don't want to answer the question, if that's in fact what happened? Let's assume for sake of argument that is what happened. I don't know that the ALJ then is deprived of being able to observe her demeanor just because she says, I don't want to answer the question, such that it would deprive him of the ability to adequately assess the demeanor over the course of a lengthy trial-like hearing. The other bigger piece of the context I think is important to understand here is that these are two questions allegedly not answered by one of two claimants in separate matters. These were two separate reported violations of university policy to the Office of Institutional Equity. Two separate women claimed that they were sexually assaulted by John Doe on the same night. The plaintiff on appeal takes exception only with the way that the hearing went vis-a-vis Jane Roe 1, taking no exception with any aspect of how Jane Roe 2's side of the hearing went. And the plaintiff has not made any assertion, any complaint, proposed or otherwise, that somehow if he had only been found to have sexually assaulted one of those women on that night, he somehow would not have been kicked out of school. So we put these two questions that they allege she didn't answer into this larger context. I think we don't have to define a precise line for purposes of this case. How many questions is too many for someone to refuse to answer?
Isn't it possible, though, that even over the course of a long hearing or a long trial or whatever, one question can make all the difference, can it? I mean, did you order the code red? I mean, it's a three-hour movie, but it's only one question. So it's possible, isn't it?
I think it is possible. I think that's a fair point, and it is possible. I don't know if that's what we have here. We have J. Roe 1 accused John Doe, and he was found to have sexually assaulted her by first trying to penetrate her with his penis and then digitally penetrating her in a stairwell. The question of who took your clothes off how did your clothes come off, when the hearing transcript, as reflected in the resolution officer's decision, says she doesn't recall, she obviously answered the question. And of course, if she doesn't recall, John Doe is free during his testimony to say, well, I recall, here's exactly what happened, Your Honor. And that becomes unrebutted testimony. So his failure to then not testify about what happened and not cure whatever deficiency he perceives with Jane Roe 1's testimony certainly isn't a deprivation of his due process. He had every opportunity to provide his side of the story and be heard, which is the minimal requirements, even as recited by the Baum decision. So, Your Honor, I think it is a fair point, but we don't have that situation here where the using your analogy, did you order the code red question is the question that's being discussed. Didn't rise to that level of if this question is answered or not, this ALJ will not be able to assess demeanor or assess the credibility of the witnesses.
Do you think if I were going to have that kind of complaint, or I was going to file that kind of complaint, are you saying I would need to plead with specificity the exact questions that were not answered, or could I be more general in my pleading, I guess? I take it your point is, I know exactly what the questions were because I was there. I mean, even without a transcript, I could write them down, and then it would be incumbent upon me to put those in a complaint.
I think it is incumbent upon the plaintiff to put those in the complaint, especially if we're talking about the code red type question that Your Honor is describing, because ultimately it would be the court then that has to decide, was that question critical enough for the resolution officer or ALJ in our situation to adequately assess the demeanor of the witnesses and make a determination about credibility to satisfy Baum and satisfy John Doe's due process rights. And in this situation, we think he absolutely received his due process.
I want to ask you two little questions, which I hope will not take much time. When you talked about the row one and row two being presented with their previously given statements, am I understanding correctly that they were asked to affirm those at the beginning of their testimony, and that provided the essential basis for what would be their direct examination at the hearing?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. And second thing, how is the hearing transcribed?
My understanding is they had a stenographer there literally typing.
A court reporter?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. All right.
Well, if that concludes that argument, we will entertain rebuttal.
Apologize. Thank you, Your Honor. I think it's important to point out that the appellees have cited no court decision that even suggests Title IX complainants can refuse to answer pre-approved cross-examination questions without suffering an adverse interest. It's also very important when we talk about the transcript issue, a couple of transcripts. First, the transcript from the district court hearing proves that Rose answers to the questions that were unanswered, that she didn't answer, would have disproven both the district court's findings and Judge Eister's erroneous conclusion that row one shut down and froze from trauma during her encounter because of the three points I talked about earlier. And I would like to directly address what was just mentioned about the for example, Judge Eister's finding that Jane Roe did not recall whether she removed her own clothing. The record proves that that's not correct. Okay, first, and it's in the briefing, but first she said that she removed her dress. Later, she said that she professed an inability to remember whether she took her clothes off. And then finally, she said that she may have been intimidated to removing her clothes because of supposed demands that Jane or John Doe was making in a threatening way, which goes to the central categories that weren't asked, which is his size, which is 95 pounds, and her ability to take off her clothes. So the reality is that the most reasonable inference here as to why appellees did not provide this transcript was because it proves, in fact, that these questions were not answered. And it goes to row two. Not just
what is your response to this, to the argument about whether you actually have requested the transcript or not? Did you request it?
Again, I was not the lawyer below, but I believe, Your Honor, that would be an irrelevant issue at a motion to dismiss stage under Baum. We have to plead beyond a reasonable wing and a prayer that the most plausible inferences made from our complaint, which is under 15, does not need to be specific like a fraud, but has to put the court on notice of what the arguments are, which we did. And so we don't have to have each question. And I guess I want to go back to Marshall and even to Baum, which say, look, when the university holds the keys to the documents, then motion to dismiss is not the proper mechanism. That's a summary judgment motion. That's what should happen. Now, if we were all looking at a transcript here, and in fact, the arguments that appellees are making are true, I would not be making the arguments we're making today.
But do you think it's enough then if you just plead, there were questions that were asked that were pre-approved that dealt with credibility, that the claimant in a credibility case refused to answer, and that violates due process. Is that enough for pleading to get by a motion to dismiss, or do you have to give more than that?
Well, to add a piece there, Your Honor, I mean, this is a case where there's no adverse inference made. Now, if that's part of the issue here, is that you can, the complainant can choose not to answer a question without any adverse inference being made. And I think that's the distinguishing factor here, because if there was an if Michigan State would have had this policy that an adverse inference was made, but I would like to close up. There are six examples of the district court construing facts against Doe. For example, when he says that Jane Roe was construed against her, it wasn't. The page that court cites does not have that information on it. That's just one of six major critical facts that the district court construed against Doe. So again, the transcript is critical here. And under Rule 15, the plaintiff does not need to submit some sort of heightened standard of pleading. It's whether it's plausible. And what's plausible here is that the district court understood this very clearly. There was a long discussion in the hearing about attire and size and why that was issued. And it talked about the fact that it was because if she could have taken off her own clothes, Your Honor, and you can read in the transcript, that would have manifest consent. I mean, Doe talks about, and this is not just in the complaint, but it's in the record, that she took off her own clothes, got on all fours, presented herself to sex, and asked for his coat to cushion her knees. So these are very important facts. Now, I see I'm almost out of time. If you have any other questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
What is the declaratory relief that you're asking for exactly? Is it prospective? Is it reinstatement, or is it something else?
Prospective reinstatement with because he's being barred from campus, so he wants to be able to go back. I mean, my client was in his last year of medical school. This expulsion has stopped him, his entire dream of going forward. He wants to be able to go back, reinstatement, and under due process, he'd have a new hearing.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. And the case is submitted.